Hewlett-Packard has had a tumultuous year. The technology company came out with its latest earnings yesterday and reported a 90% drop in income. That's still better than what Wall Street analysts were expecting. NPR's Wendy Kaufman has more.
A year ago, HP earned $2.5 billion in the fourth quarter. This year, it was less than $240 million. The company had a sizable write-off in part of its mobile business, and its personal computing unit remains weak. But the biggest news for the quarter was the management shakeup. The board ousted the chief executive and brought in former eBay CEO Meg Whitman.
Actually, I'm very impressed. She's focusing the company back on financial basics.
That's veteran technology analyst Rob Enderle.
She's approached this methodically, and that's really what the company needed. They needed somebody not to come in and, you know, parachute in and start firing from the hip, but somebody to come in and learn what the strengths and weaknesses were and then make decisions based on facts.
One of Whitman's first decisions was to not spin off the company's huge PC business. That's something her predecessor had proposed over the summer. Still, the company faces considerable challenges. Industry-wide, PC sales are declining, and many of HP's other business units are also seeing drops in revenues and profits. Indeed, the company's forecast for the first quarter of next year is weaker than Wall Street had been projecting. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. In Manhattan's Zuccotti Park today, protesters announced the Occupy Student Debt campaign. Professor Andrew Ross of New York University called on a million borrowers to stop paying their student loans. The mission of the campaign?
To give debtors a chance to act.
To give debtors a chance to act.
Collectively.
Collectively.
In an area of their lives.
In an area of their lives.
Where they have been rendered entirely powerless.
As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, the effort is part of a growing movement to ease the burden on students who say the grim economy makes it impossible to pay back their loans.
Professor Andrew Ross says Occupy Wall Streeters embrace the student debt campaign out of a sense of social justice.
Banks with huge debt are very easily bailed out by the federal government. But individuals who suffer on a long-term basis have been neglected.
You can hear the tales of beleaguered student debtors at many Occupy encampments, or you can listen online via YouTube or the student loan documentary called Default.
They now say that I owe about $90,000, so it's tripled. They can seize Social Security, they can seize tax refunds, they can garnish your wages.
The number of students with six-figure debt is actually very small, but the average debt is rising steadily to over $25,000 today. That kind of debt should be manageable if students can find a job, and many cannot. Justin Hamilton, spokesman for the Department of Education, says an organized default could simply steal opportunity from the next generation.
Our ability to make money available for students is contingent on this program operating successfully. So, yes, it could potentially hurt future students.
The department now issues all of the government-backed student loans and has largely cut banks out of the equation. In fact, some of the complaints seem to focus on alleged mistreatment by banks who served as middlemen under a system that ended last year. The government says that shift has saved money, and the extra cash has gone into a big expansion of federal grants for students. Still, Robert Applebaum of ForgiveStudentLoanDebt.com says excusing these loans would serve a larger purpose. It would pump new money into the economy by freeing up students to do what they cannot do now.
They're not starting businesses. They're not starting families. They're not investing. They're not innovating. They're not doing any of the economically stimulative things that we need all Americans to be doing right now.
Many question that, saying forgiveness would inject at most a few billion dollars into the economy and would accomplish little. But the call for reducing student debt and for more government spending on education has spread around the world. Students in Chile have succeeded in shutting down many universities there during months of protests, some violent. They're demanding no-interest or low-interest loans, as well as a massive increase of government support for higher education. The government there has offered limited spending increases, but not enough to stop the protests. In the U.S., most experts believe there's little chance the government would ever forgive student loans. They now add up to nearly $1 trillion. Ongoing deficit negotiations in Congress have raised the prospect that student aid may, if anything, face further cuts. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
Another new movie paying tribute to old films was directed by Martin Scorsese. He's made his share of dark and bloody pictures, think Goodfellas and Gangs of New York, so it was hard for critic Kenneth Turan to imagine him directing Hugo, a film based on a children's book.
Hugo is Hugo Cabret, a 12-year-old boy in 1931 Paris who lives by himself in the upper reaches of a massive train station. He rushes around through hidden corridors like a preteen Phantom of the Opera as he keeps all the station's clocks wound and in good repair. Hugo is still mourning the recent death of his father. He tries to stay connected to him by searching for the spare parts he needs to repair a mysterious machine the two of them were working on.
What is it?
It's a wind-up figure, like a music box.
Who built him?
I would think a magician.
That obsessive quest for gears leads to a head-on collision with the gruff old man, played by Ben Kingsley, but the old man also has a ward named Isabel, who is always up for adventure.
Who are you?
Hugo.
Where do you live?
Is it a secret?
Yes. Oh, good, I love secrets.
Hugo's creative use of 3D is magical. The film's numerous panoramic shots floating over the rooftops of Paris create a delightful sense of wonder. The original story in Brian Selznick's award-winning children's book is strictly serious, but for reasons of its own, the movie has chosen to add a major slapstick element. It doesn't work. But coming to the film's rescue is one of Martin Scorsese's great passions, his love for the early history of the movies. Hugo deals extensively with one of cinema's key pioneers, the great Georges Méliès. Méliès says, films have the power to capture dreams. They've captured Scorsese's, but he doesn't completely capture ours.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition in the Los Angeles Times. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
President Obama today put the blame for the Super Committee's failure squarely on congressional Republicans and on their unwillingness to consider higher taxes on the wealthy.
They simply will not budge from that negotiating position. And so far, that refusal continues to be the main stumbling block that has prevented Congress from reaching an agreement to further reduce our deficit.
And as we've already said, Mr. Obama also threatened to veto any effort to escape from the automatic spending cuts agreed to in August without a balanced plan to reduce the deficit. Balanced meaning a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. And Scott, in some of the budget battles earlier this year, the president was very hands-on, driving up to Capitol Hill, calling lawmakers to the White House. We didn't see any of that with the Super Committee.
No, we really didn't, Robert. When the Super Committee was just starting its work back in September, the president came out and spelled out his roadmap for a balanced deficit reduction plan, something that would shave more than $3 trillion off the deficit. And then about 10 days ago, as he was setting off on his Asian Pacific trip, he called the committee co-chairs to sort of offer some encouragement and say he's there if they need him. But other than that, he really kind of kept the super committee at a distance.
Why? What was the thinking here?
Well, one of the things he said tonight was that the situation is very different than it was in some of those earlier budget battles. We weren't faced with an impending government shutdown that was going to come in on a spring break weekend. It wasn't like the summer deadline to raise the debt ceiling, when if there wasn't a deal, we could have seen a federal default. So we did see a big drop in the stock market today as Congress lived down to expectations, but there's no real immediate fallout. And then secondarily, there was real question about whether the president's more active involvement would have been helpful in this case. Some members of the super committee were saying, we just as soon have him stay over at the White House, let us do our work. Mm-hmm. And the White House said repeatedly it was a congressional responsibility to deal with this. One analyst I talked to said, it's like waving a red cape in front of Republicans if you have Mr. Obama coming over and cheering them on.
He was criticized, though, by Mitt Romney, who criticized them for not being active enough. And there's a certain theme to criticism of President Obama, that he's aloof, that he's not in there in the fight.
Mitt Romney certainly was making that case in New Hampshire over the weekend, and he's not the only one who's made that case. Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, was here in Washington a couple of weeks ago arguing for a big balanced deficit solution, and he said it's fine to give the president credit for laying out a plan. That was good, but that's not enough. That's not what a CEO would have done. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, went further, arguing that the president was actively rooting for failure by the supercommittee, saying that would step on his sort of campaign line that he's running against a do-nothing Congress.
So what's next?
Well, one way or another, the president says, we are going to get another $1.2 trillion in deficit reduction. It might come through some sort of compromise deal, or it might come through those automatic spending cuts that were agreed to in the summer. Those are supposed to be split between domestic and military spending. Some lawmakers have been very alarmed at what that would mean for the Pentagon and saying they're going to try to maneuver out of it. Mr. Obama said today he would veto any such effort.
There will be no easy off-ramps on this one. We need to keep the pressure up to compromise, not turn off the pressure.
So the pressure remains on Congress. But remember, those spending cuts, those automatic spending cuts, aren't due to kick in until the beginning of 2013. So it's a sort of a long drawn-out pressure on Congress. The more immediate challenge, as you pointed out with Tamara, Robert, is what to do about extending the payroll tax cut and unemployment insurance. That deadline comes December 31st.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
That's NPR's Scott Horsley. Modern media liberate us from the bonds of time and place. Buy a record, or before that a wax cylinder, and you could hear Caruso singing without ever leaving Missoula. Movies, digital photographs, archived sound files and podcasts, streaming videos of lectures and performances, all of these breakthroughs redefine what is accessible to us, what is potentially familiar. Compound that expanded universe of the available with mobile devices, and our remote location or our busy schedule becomes merely a minor inconvenience to experiencing things. Well, perhaps it's inevitable that this markdown of the value of the here and now would stimulate a reaction. And here's an interesting one. Pop-up magazine. It happens once, in one place, unrecorded. Now you see it, if not, you don't. Douglas McGray is the editor of Pop-Up, and he joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And tell us what Pop-Up magazine is. Describe it.
Pop-Up magazine is a live magazine. It's a magazine that's performed on stage. You have a table of contents, and you have a series of about 20 stories in 90 minutes, and they're documentary filmmakers, writers, radio producers, photographers, and artists who present their work to a live audience live on stage.
And many of their presentations are very short.
They are very short. The shortest one we've ever done was 17 seconds. They run up to about maybe 5 or 6 minutes long, and you find that that's enough time to tell a rich story or profile a person or explain an idea.
And the person who's presenting comes out on stage and does this just speech, or do they have pictures or sounds to accompany them?
There is a big screen at the back of the stage, and the person comes out, the presenter takes the mic, and then they will read. And sometimes they just read. Sometimes there's film that comes up behind them. Sometimes we'll use the sound system, and you'll hear voices or sound that's playing in the theater. We've even had live musical accompaniment to pieces. So they can be very simple and very lo-fi, or they can be these rich multimedia immersive experiences.
Magazines are edited. Is this one edited?
It is. You know, we reach out to potential contributors we admire, and people come to us, and we'll talk stories the way that an editor will talk with a writer. Once we figure out what makes sense to do on stage, sometimes we'll collaborate really closely and figure out how we can encourage someone to experiment with different forms. We'll have a radio producer who will decide that they're going to try out using some Super 8 film or using some images, or we'll have an illustrator who will get paired with someone who works in sound. So it's a lot like a magazine. It just happens to be live and ephemeral.
Now, in theory, you could make it less than ephemeral. You could take the same people who presented and have both a matinee and an evening performance, or have it several days a week. But you've definitely decided that's not what this is all about.
Well, one thing that we've found that's really interesting is we started this show in a small theater. And the reason we started it was we felt that filmmakers have their film openings, and artists will have gallery openings, and writers will have their readings. And we're never at the same things together. We thought about stories, the idea of a live magazine as a way to bring these different communities together and bring their communities of fans together.
Now, there's live, and then there's live. You could have a script and go back and do the live show the next day if you wanted to.
I find that people watch a thing differently when it really is only going to happen once. You can't share the link to your favorite story. You're going to have to retell it yourself. And you can't go back and watch something later. I think you focus in a different way, and I think you remember in a different way. And I like the way it makes people's brains work, and we've gotten great feedback to that effect, that people, when they come and when the lights go down, they feel like they're about to see something special precisely because it's only going to happen once.
And in fact, when I first emailed you about this, I asked, suspecting the answer, if there was any sound, any recorded moment that we might be able to hear on the program. The answer is no, you don't have it.
It's true. We don't even have secret recordings or photographs for ourselves. When I think back to old issues and think fondly of moments that were really terrific, I'm just remembering them.
The way it used to be at one time.
And I should say that this is not a negative reaction to technology, because all of us are online, all of us are on social media, and a lot of ways the huge audience for this show has been built on social media. These are great ways to connect and to share ideas and to meet people. It's also just nice to unplug and come together for a night and do something that's different.
Well, Douglas McRae, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks so much.
Douglas McRae is the editor of Pop-Up Magazine, which, as you heard, isn't exactly a magazine. He spoke to us from San Francisco.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.